I'm State Senator Jeff Brandis from the great state of Florida. I'm finishing up a decade of service in the Florida legislature. The one thing you need to know about me is I am a Christian. I'm not an attorney. So I am up here as a state senator who has served on the Criminal Justice Committee, who has served as the Criminal Justice Appropriations Chair, but have no legal background other than having served on those committees. So I'm excited to take part of this discussion today and look at the future of DNA, DNA matching, and really the future of science as it relates to solving cold cases. There are over 250,000 unsolved cases in this country, and more grow every single day. Usually a cold case is something that's considered something that can go cold in as quickly as a week, but generally the definition of a cold case is something that really is unresolved for more than a year, and where you have no new evidence or leads. And so that's really what we're talking about, cases that are put in filing boxes, filed away, waiting for new evidence, new leads, and the emerging technology that allows us to explore those as we move into the future. So today I'm joined by our three distinguished panelists. First, to your left, we have Sergeant Joseph Vasquez, works in the Denver Police Department, a Major Crimes Cold Division, Cold Case Homicide Unit. He is a military veteran who serves as a hospital corpsman with the 24th Marine Division during its deployment in Iraq and as part of Operation Iraqi Freedom. So welcome. Next, we have David Middleman, is the founder and CEO of Authrum, the world's first private DNA laboratory built specifically to apply the power of modern parallel sequencing to forensic evidence. All right, let me use this. Testing, all right. He has participated in the Human Genome Project while at the University of Texas Southwest Medical Center and later received his PhD in molecular biophysics from Baylor College of Medicine. Middleman started his own NIH-funded research program as an associate professor at Virginia Tech. And finally, we have Kristen Middleman, who is the Chief Development Officer for Authrum, a biometrics company using DNA sequencing and genomics to advance human identification. She joined two global firms to advise clients on intellectual property issues and a variety of scientific and medical fields by drafting patent applications. Middleman received her PhD in biochemistry and molecular biology from Baylor College of Medicine. And with that, we're going to turn it over to you, Kristen, and have us walk us through this PowerPoint.
Thank you, everyone, for being here and letting me talk about forensic genetic genealogy and how and how I think it can help create a safer and more just world through the power of advanced genomics. So, okay, I'm going to start by talking about baseline forensic technology. So in the past, forensic technology was purpose-built to confirm identity rather than to determine identity. So many of you have heard of CODIS testing or the CODIS testing system, in which they're looking at 20 markers in the DNA found from a perpetrator, usually, and then that's entered into the CODIS database of other known perpetrators. And if the person exists in that database, then you've confirmed that that person can be linked to that crime as well. But it's a lot less effective in actually determining identity. So many, many of these cold cases that the senator spoke of, when you enter it into conventional forensic DNA testing, you don't have a lead. It ends up being a DNA dead end. And this is especially true when it comes to victims. So victims' DNA is usually never in these known perpetrator databases. And so if you don't know who your victim is, you can't start investigating your crime. And you can't really start to figure out what happened to them or who may be accountable for that crime. And so our technology comes into play to help determine that identity and provide that investigative lead to the detectives. So forensic genetic genealogy is a two-part process. You have the advanced DNA analysis, that's what's done in a laboratory, and then that's combined with the power of traditional genealogy research, and that returns an investigative lead. Authrum is the first lab of its kind in the world. We're actually the only lab in the world still that is purpose-built to take advanced genomics and apply it to forensic evidence. We don't do any medical testing. We don't do any consumer testing. We actually do quite the opposite. We built our entire process to use the most powerful sequencer on Earth and adopt a process that would allow that sequencer to take pictures and to be able to make one of these DNA profiles from the most difficult and intractable forensic evidence inputs. And so if you think about it, medical testing and consumer testing, it's geared towards fresh DNA, large quantities of DNA, DNA that you can get more of, you can go back to the source and get more of, DNA that's not contaminated, it's not mixtures, it's not super degraded. Forensic DNA is the exact opposite. You're working with trace amounts, you're working with contamination, you're working with degradation, difficult mixtures, and so the process has had to be completely reinvented from scratch. And if you see when I talk in a little bit, you'll be able to compare the differences in those two methods. So just like the senator said, there's hundreds of thousands of unsolved cold cases in the U.S. right now. There are 40,000 unidentified remains in Namis alone. And then there's 250, or over 250, unsolved cold cases. That's known as a silent mass disaster. I put this little iceberg here because the cases that you guys have heard being solved using these different, you know, DNA technologies that may have been created for medicine or for consumer testing, that's the tip of the iceberg. And yes, sometimes the DNA is good enough and you end up being able to solve those cases. But unfortunately, most of these cases are underwater and they would be intractable. Those inputs would be completely intractable to the DNA testing methods that are out there right now. And so we purpose built in order to be able to bring justice to all cases. We at Authorum don't believe it's justice unless every case can have a chance to be able to be tested with the same method in order to get an identity. So who are the stakeholders for FGG? Obviously, the first stakeholder is law enforcement or the medical examiner office if it's unidentified remains. Those are the people that have the case. Those are the people that are in charge of the investigation. They're the ones that identify that using this type of DNA testing could potentially help their investigation because they, at this point, do not have any more DNA leads. The next part is the forensic lab. That's what we do at Authorum. We help build one of these profiles, DNA profiles, that can be entered into a genealogy database that is consented for law enforcement use, and then we're able to identify either the perpetrator or the victim. At Authorum, we do both this second and third puzzle piece from beginning to end. We work directly with law enforcement from evidence all the way to the courtroom, which is the next part, prosecutors and defense attorneys, in order to speak onto the technology and make sure that it's admissible in court. And the last piece is you guys, and that's why I'm here today. So it's policymakers, the public, and advocates. And I think this is the most important piece now. In order for this technology to be adopted, accepted, we need you guys to believe that it can be used to solve all these other cold cases and to help us sort of move to the next phase of this. So when we first started, we heard a lot about there's not enough DNA in my case, so we can't use your type of technology. Because their case was one of those cases in the water in that iceberg picture. So here's an example. This is Stephanie Isaacson. She was a 14-year-old girl. She was walking to school in Las Vegas in 1989, and she was brutally sexually assaulted and murdered in broad daylight. The only remaining evidence that was left after all the testing that was done was 0.12 nanograms of DNA. That is about 15 human cells. If I touch my hand, I've left hundreds of cells right now. So 15 human cells from a 32-year-old sex assault murder of Stephanie Isaacson, and that was enough DNA for Authorum to build a DNA profile, identify her perpetrator, and when it was confirmed by CODIS testing, he actually linked to yet another crime 3 years before of another young lady that he had also raped and murdered. Oh, sorry, it went backwards. The next thing we hear often is the DNA is too old. It's too degraded, it's not good enough for your process. Here's a case where we identified a murder victim. She was actually a school teacher from 1881. So if the case is newer than 1881, we have a good chance of being able to build a DNA profile and identify either the perpetrator or the victim. We hear that the technology may not be inclusive. Only certain people can be identified using these DNA profiles. At Othram, we create profiles that have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of markers. And like I told you earlier, we're using the most powerful sequencer on Earth, so the pictures may be clearer than what they were before. With our technology, we don't see that it's not inclusive. We've been able to make several, and I thought about a way to describe this to you today or show you. We've had several indigenous identities over the last few months. We've identified people from all biogeographical backgrounds. But I think this is a really good way to describe it. We have a philanthropist in the state of Mississippi. Her name is Carla Davis, and she has vowed to pay for every case that is an unidentified remains case. So in that state, we were able to call the medical examiner's office and say, send us any one of your unidentified remain cases and code it, name us, and let us solve that case. And so we started to solve many of them at once. And as you can see by looking at the faces of our initial solves with this project, it really is technology that's inclusive of everyone. Here, we're not picking the case. We're not choosing whether it's perpetrator, victim, or anything. We're actually just identifying every case that is available in the state. So where do we go from here? I want to show you the leaps and bounds that this technology has made from the time that medical testing or consumer testing was used to build these DNA profiles to having Othram make it purpose-built in 2022 now, and show you the difference of what can be done. So if you're wondering if a case is suitable, now there are some parameters out there. In 2019, you needed 20 nanograms of DNA to build one of these profiles. I just showed you a case where we used 0.12 nanograms of DNA. In 2019, it was a strong maybe if you could work with degraded or old DNA evidence. Right now, our assay is completely insensitive to degradation. It doesn't matter how sheared up the DNA is, we're able to build a DNA profile. In 2019, you could process skeletal remains, but it would take 100 nanograms of DNA. We've been able to identify unidentified remains with less than 0.2 nanograms of DNA now. In 2019, hairs was not an input that you could use to build these profiles. Although I'll be honest and tell you that it's still the riskiest input to build these profiles, and we have to think about it in a case-by-case basis, it now is possible. FFPE blocks, that's the chemical treatment that they do when they create blocks during the autopsy. That was never done, and that was not possible in 2019. We were able to identify the Walker County Jane Doe as Sherry Ann Jarvis. She was another 14-year-old girl brutally attacked and murdered and left on the side of the highway in Texas. And she was originally from Minnesota. There would have been no way to connect her back to family or to who she was. There was no connection between the missing person record and the body found in Texas until we were able to use our new methods to be able to work with evidence inputs that were previously intractable. The last thing is imputation. In 2019, people heavily relied on imputation on these profiles. We believe that we need to focus on the forensic process and collect better data rather than use any computer tricks to create these DNA profiles. Another question that you'll hear a lot of is, can you tell me what someone looks like from their DNA? Well, I believe that the goal of forensic genetic genealogy is to remove doubt and uncertainty from a case, not only to give you the name of the perpetrator or the victim, but also to immediately exclude people that might have been thought to be possible suspects in the investigation. So I wrote here, why would I give you a phenotype information that could be biased when I can give you a name? And I think the better way to represent this is, we had a case out of Snohomish County. We used 0.18 nanograms to identify the Lake Stickney John Doe case. And we were able to identify him as Rodney Johnson. His picture is to the right of the slide there. But you can see all of these graphical representations that were made of him. And although some of the features are similar, it would be unlikely that from those graphical representations you would have picked Rodney as the victim. And that's why I think it's important to do something that's certain rather than something that might be hypothetical. The last question I'm going to talk to you about is, how many cases have you solved? I think that's the wrong question. Although Othram has solved more cases than anyone else on Earth using this technology now, and we've touched more evidence than anyone else on Earth using this technology because we're purpose-built for this, the real question that law enforcement should be asking is, how many similar cases have you helped solve, help law enforcement solve using this technology? And can you predict your success? At Othram, we have a very stringent QC process. DNA testing is a destructive process. Every time you run that test, you consume that DNA. And often with it, you consume someone's last chance of being identified or of getting justice. And so I believe that you shouldn't be running evidence unless you've put it through a QC process that predictably can tell you that you can actually build one of these profiles because you've done something extremely similar before. If we get an evidence type in that is completely different from anything we've ever done before, we actually fail at AQC. We don't charge law enforcement and we do not consume the evidence. Instead, we go back and do R&D until we can go back to that case and confidently feel that we can build one of these DNA profiles. I'm going to quickly go over one case study. It's the Carla Walker case. I chose this one because it has huge impact and because it went all the way through court. But Carla Walker was a 17-year-old cheerleader in Fort Worth, Dallas, and outside of Dallas. And she was dating the high school quarterback. She was one of the most popular girls at school. Everyone loved her. She had a wonderful family. And she went to the Valentine's dance with Rodney, her boyfriend, and after the dance, they stopped at a bowling alley to use the restroom. They were sitting outside the bowling alley in a car, and someone came to the door of the car, hit Rodney in the head with the back of a gun, and abducted Carla. She was found 3 days later in a culvert. She had been raped, beaten, and strangled. There were hundreds of leads exhausted in this investigation back in 1974. They had found the magazine of the .22 Ruger pistol that was used to hit Rodney in the head. Rodney was a person of interest in the investigation very early on because he wasn't killed at the crime scene. He didn't drive to the police station. In fact, he drove to Carla's house because the last thing she said to him was, "Go get my dad." He also was hit in the head, and so his story changed a few times. He thought a hat had fallen off the perpetrator. It ended up being the magazine from the gun that had fallen. And so a lot of people believed that he might have been involved in the crime. Media, Unsolved Mysteries, DNA of Murder, made Rodney seem like he may have been involved in the crime. I've actually gotten the opportunity to meet Rodney, and he told me that he had to exile himself to Alaska because he felt like he couldn't live with the scrutiny of people not knowing whether he had something to do with killing Carla. Paul Holes, he was the lead detective in The Golden State Killer. He had the show DNA of Murder. David actually knew him as a friend, and they had the episode on Carla Walker. And David called him and said, "Whatever happened with the DNA testing you pursued?" And unfortunately, they had pursued DNA testing from another lab that used medical testing or consumer testing to do this technology and not purpose-built technology for this, and they had consumed the 10 nanograms of sample and with no profile. So the only thing remaining was a much smaller stain that was a much more degraded DNA stain and much less in amount, and Paul said, "David, I don't think there's enough DNA to test. I think this case is over." And David said, I'd like to take a try. And so they sent the evidence to our lab, and we were able to build a profile from this fraction, 1/10 of the DNA that was sent to the other labs. And we were able to, within 5 weeks, identify Glenn McCurley as a perpetrator, for as the murderer of Carla Walker. So when David returned the investigative lead back to the detective, he actually recognized the name. And he said, oh my gosh, he's on the list of people that had that type of gun in the area. He was actually interviewed back in 1974 and said that his gun had been stolen while he was fishing. And so investigators called Glenn McCurley in for another interview, at which point he confessed to the crime and agreed to provide a DNA sample for confirmation. He was charged, the DNA sample confirmed as it was Glenn McCurley, and he was charged with capital murder. At that point, he recanted his confession and pled not guilty. There was a trial in August of 2021, and our technology had to go both to the Daubert hearing and was cross-examined in a jury trial for the very first time, this type of technology. And it was admissible. It was found admissible 3 days later. And Glenn McCurley changed his plea yet again to guilty, and now he is sentenced to life in prison. Why did I choose this case to talk to you about today? The first reason I chose the Carla Walker case is because it's one of the first families I met after we started actually solving these cases. Now we've helped with, you know, thousands of cases. But at that point, this was one of our very first criminal cases that we had worked on. And I got to meet her brother. And the very, very first time that I met him, he said, it has been 18,287 days, I believe is the number he quoted me, since the day I wanted to know what happened to my sister. And I finally have an answer. And I remember thinking, oh my God, he knew the actual number of days. And he told me he had never moved away from that home, hoping that somebody would knock on the door and let him know what they had done as sort of an end-of-life confession. He would spend the night in the culvert that they found his sister in, hoping that the perpetrator would come back so that he could confront him. It had been 46 years, but for him, his life was stuck at that moment because he needed to know what happened to his sister. He became a law enforcement agent trying to figure out what happened to his sister and never gave up. Then I also met Rodney, and as I told you, he told me he was not able to live a normal life because he felt like until someone was actually convicted for Carla's crime, he was always going to be under scrutiny. I'm also talking about this. I met hundreds of Carla's friends at our celebration of life. The community as a whole was affected by this crime. And so these crimes go so much further than just the family affected or just the victim. All the cases that we've worked, I've worked with detectives, law enforcement agents that were the ones that discovered bodies or worked this case for decades. Their lives have changed because of it. So every time you are able to bring closure to one of these cases, you're actually giving answers to not just a small number of people, but hundreds of people. Then I wanted to talk to you about it because of the admissibility in court. And then the last part was we have Congressman Kelly Armstrong out of North Dakota putting forth a bipartisan bill called the Carla Walker Act that is going to ask for dedicated funds for the deployment of this technology. And I get to my last slide here, and that's how can you guys help me? I mean, the science has changed. The science is there to be able to solve all those cold cases in that iceberg, not just the ones that are over water. The question is, what's missing? And what's missing time and time again is funding. Law enforcement has entered into our system so many cases that we don't have the funding for yet. Law enforcement, we've built relationships with so many agencies across the country that trust us to clear their entire backlogs, but they don't have the funding because the funding is geared towards legacy technology. We have a big step forward this year. The FY 2023 CJS appropriations bill, as you told me you sat on that committee, that for the first time recognized right now that this technology, the power of this technology, and that more grant programs need to utilize FGG. Also, several community development projects were awarded to local law enforcement agencies to use FGG to be able to clear their backlogs, sort of a pilot program. And last, Senator Lisa Baker from Pennsylvania is working to create specific state funding for this type of technology in her area. So if any of you are in any way interested in helping try to create new funds for this technology, guardrails for this technology, I'm here to talk anytime. I'm here to answer questions today. I'll be here after this session, or you can go to request.authram.com and get on my calendar, and I'll be happy to speak with each one of you individually. Thank you again for your time. I really appreciate it.
Switch out computers to get to another PowerPoint presentation. So walk me through the time frame. A sample comes in. What's the kind of time frame that it takes for you guys to, one, determine whether you have a viable sample, and two, to run through your process?
So it varies depending on the condition of the evidence, but we quote 12 weeks from the time that we get the evidence and to build one of these DNA profiles. As far as the matches in the database, that depends. For the genealogy part after that, so that's varied. Sometimes you can solve them in hours, sometimes it takes days, sometimes it takes a month. But we quote 12 weeks. Often we build profiles much sooner. The Carla Walker case was 5 weeks until all the way to investigative lead. But we don't want to overpromise and underdeliver, so 12 weeks.
Sergeant Joseph Vasquez with the Denver Police Department, who has just a few slides and discuss a little bit about his experience solving some of these cold cases.
Can everybody hear me? I'm Sergeant Joseph Vasquez with the Denver Police Department. I don't have very many slides. I'm kind of old school. I use the yellow notes and stuff like that. So our department has been pretty successful with the collaborations between our lab, our DA, and the detectives. And one of the cases in point is the Joe Urban case. So during the course of 1978, 1980, and 1981, we had three women who were murdered. We believe two of them at that time, or they believe two of them at that time had been sexually assaulted, and they had all been stabbed. Those investigations were ran to ground during the course of that time, and they never really came to fruition. The detectives and the officers collected evidence, preserved that evidence, interviewed several people, but they were just not able to move the needle on solving those cases. During that same time, there was another case in Adams County, Colorado, which is an adjacent jurisdiction, and there was another homicide that took place at that time, and there was never any link between these cases. The unfortunate part of these old school investigations is that a lot of times detectives didn't talk to each other, police departments don't talk to each other, and even now we have those problems. There's no internet, there's no databases, there's no way to tie some of these cases. So during the course of that decade, these cases really didn't go anywhere. So then we fast forward to about 2011, and we reviewed the cases that were in our jurisdiction. And one of the cases, the Dolores Barajas case, was reviewed by a detective who looked at the case, and at the time the detective didn't think she had been sexually assaulted, but the detective in that case re-examined the case, examined the evidence, and retested some of the evidence in that case, and it turned out that that case was in fact a sex assault. Is that right? Okay. So there's DNA cultivated through these cases and it's put into CODIS, but there is no match that comes back. The best way I can explain it is that it keeps spinning and spinning and spinning, but however, we don't have an identified suspect. And that's frustrating because in a lot of these cases, you may have a full DNA profile and you might have case-to-case matches, as we did here, but we don't have an identified suspect. So the cases continue to be worked and they continue to be linked. And then at some point in 2019 and 2020, funding comes by way of some grants. There's a couple of grants that we're operating on. One of them is the Cold Case Prosecution Grant. We've had that for about two years now. And we work closely with the District Attorney's Office and the Denver Police Department Crime Lab. Another grant is the genealogy grant that's kind of in its infancy. This case was examined during the course of that grant, and some of the DNA was tested in our lab, and we were able to cultivate some DNA, and we were able to find out some information leading us to a possible relative of a suspect. That relative was born in Texas in 1871. So with that, we can't really do too much. We have to go to old school detective work. We have to go through death records, obituary notices, and things like that. We were able to enlist the help of the Texas Rangers. So the Texas Rangers were able to do some work for us, and they were able to help us out because they were receiving funding through the Sex Assault Kit Initiative. So that was able to pay for a lot of the work they did, knocking on doors, finding documents, and ultimately finding out through their investigation that there is an individual that they can tie to that DNA through what they did was a familial search. That familial search revealed an individual by the name of Paul Irvin, who was in Texas doing time for a homicide. He was interviewed, his DNA was compared to those cases, and it didn't match. So we were looking about the same street, but not in the same area, I guess, the best way to put it. So further investigation by the Texas Rangers, they were able to find out that there is a brother of Paul Irvin named Joe Irvin. Joe Irvin had been found to have been living at some time during Denver in Denver. He had some addresses, that one of them being not too far from one of the homicides, and during the course of the investigation, they gave us the information, and we looked and found that Joe Irvin had been, he had killed himself in July of 1981. So this talks about some of the work that we did and some of the funding and some of the grants. It's all about money. The big thing is that we have a group of detectives that will work on these cases, exclusively cold case detectives, but we also will enlist other detectives in major crimes, in the sex crimes unit, the homicide unit, some other units. But the thing is that we can't get them to do these cases unless we can get paid for them. So a lot of the funding is important because they're able to work these cases as sort of an off-time investigation, and they're compensated. Sometimes they won't even put in for it. They'll just work them anyway. Let's see. So in looking at Joe Irvin, we find out that he, like I said, he committed suicide in July of 1981. The circumstances behind his suicide was that in June of 1981, he was stopped by Deborah Secor, an Aurora police officer who did a routine traffic stop, contacted him, and he attacked her and he killed her. He was able to get away. They found him not too far from the crime scene in a not too long period of time, and they actually found him trying to saw the handcuff off of his hand. He was arrested. He was put into jail for that murder, but he also shot another person in that event, and then he killed himself a month later. Now, none of this information was tied at that time. It was tied later on in the investigation done like 40 years later. So what we did find out was that Mr. Irvin was buried in Texas. So we have to reach out to the Texas Rangers again. So the Texas Rangers, who did a remarkable amount of work on this, established where his burial plot was, got a court order, and they were able to exhume his body. There wasn't a lot left, but there was enough to test for DNA. So they were able to take samples, bring them back to Denver, and through ultimate testing done by our crime lab, they were able to make that match. It took a lot of work, a lot of time, and a lot of effort, because these cases don't move at lightning speed. We have a lot of issues in terms of degradation of evidence, destruction of evidence. We have a district attorney who is probably one of the best in the country. If she's going to take a case, she wants a lot of things in line and a lot of things that she can take to court that aren't going to have any kind of questions or are going to be problematic. I think this case kind of highlights that a lot of this is just based on the work that the detectives do, the lab, the genealogy, which is, like I said, really in its infancy, and we're still trying to get our get our sea legs when it comes to that. So we do have a funding, we do have that grant in place, and we're still trying to utilize it, and we're actively working some cases now. But a lot of it is the collaboration with the district attorney's office, the labs, and the detectives. I think that the important part of these investigations is just trying to get our heads around what we need to do, because we have a lot of detectives that want to be involved, they want to do the work, but unfortunately, you know, we're kind of in a at a space right now where we're having a lot of problems with funding, like everyone else. We're trying to get bodies, we're trying to get people to become police officers. But I think that these investigations never stop. The great thing for us is there's no statute limitations on murder, so we can always pick them up at any given time and keep working them. And it's important that the families and the people know that, you know, we don't forget. We continue to investigate and we continue to work these cases. I think there's some frustration with some of us where we get these calls daily from family members, and they want to know what happened to my son's case, what happened to my daughter's case, what happened. And I think sometimes we fail to realize that this is something to have to live with every day. As a homicide detective, we work with the case for maybe 48 hours, 2 weeks, and a month, and then God forbid we catch another case within another few days, and we try to remember these victims or have to live with this for the rest of their lives. So. I guess the best thing I can impress upon everybody is that funding is important. Things are still moving along. The detectives that work these cases, over the weekend we had several homicides, and those cases are being actively worked by detectives who preserve the evidence, try to do the best things they can. When I was a homicide detective, when I was a cold case detective, I had a case from 1975, I believe, and a detective went on scene, and it was a young man who had been beaten to death, and he was found in an alley where there's a lot of trash and there was a lot of debris, and he was lured there and he was killed. This detective at that time examined the crime scene and he found one cigarette butt, and he collected that for evidence. And this is in the 70s, so when I get the case, it's submitted for DNA. It comes back to an individual who we were able to identify as being the person who killed this man. The detective at that time, I interviewed him 30 or 40 years later, I don't know, whatever, in the 70s, this is the 2000s, and I asked him, why did you collect that cigarette butt? He says, I really don't have an answer, because you can't get a fingerprint off a cigarette butt. I said, do you think that you were going to get DNA? And he says, boy, I can't even spell DNA. This is from the 70s. Nobody, I go, what were you thinking? Why would you even, because DNA was not around in the 70s. And I said, why would you even collect that cigarette butt? And he said to me, I just thought maybe someday something could be done with it. And I says, well, what do you have, like a hot tub time machine? How did you know this? He said, I don't know, son. I just knew maybe someday something could be done. And that's why I think that it's important that we continue this evolution. It's important we have these conversations, and it's important that we try to advance the technology in terms of solving these cases. Thank you.
Absolutely.
We have about 15 minutes for questions. If you have any questions, there's two microphones here. I'd like to get through a few questions.
Those dudes don't mess
around. I'm going to take your questions this time.
Hi, this is David Amatis from Prison Fellowship. Related DNA issue, but not specifically touched on here. I know this raises a lot of really important questions about due process and civil liberties, but I know there's been some research showing that increasing the pool of individuals with criminal records into DNA databases can actually deter and reduce crime based on studies from Denmark and other places. So curious your thoughts on that question.
You want to take it?
I barely heard part of what you said.
More about the privacy and expanding the databases.
Okay. I think you're asking, if I understand correctly, you're asking if including more folks that have committed crimes in the database would act as an effective way to solve crimes and or as a deterrent against crime.
Mainly on the deterrent side.
On the deterrent side?
You mean deterring people from committing crimes? People commit crimes for various reasons. I think it's rare that sometimes people will think of that far ahead. Criminals are getting smarter. In the old days, they just walked up and started blasting somebody and they didn't give it two thoughts. Now they know we can do some forensic science with shell casings. They know there's video everywhere. I think when I first got on the job, it blew my mind that guys would do shootings and then they'd come back and pick up the shell casings. These guys are leaving phones. They're doing all these things to probably make themselves not get caught. So I don't think it's a deterrence because we're two steps behind them. We're always two steps behind them. So I think that, and some of these scenes, how do you clean up a frenetic crime scene? It's not easy. We still can get blood, DNA from crime scenes several weeks or days or months afterward. So I don't know if they're really thinking that way. For some crimes, these guys are planning it out and thinking. They're leaving their phones because they know we can do warrants and stuff like that. But I don't think some of these guys are thinking that all the way.
You know,
I don't know if that answers your question.
And I think it's important to point out that the commercial sites like 23andMe and Ancestry.com, they don't allow law enforcement to, that you have to opt in, and they don't allow the law enforcement to access their databases. So it's important to know that other groups, groups like Authorum use third-party organizations where the individuals have opted in. And I think the legislative questions that we would have would be if, you know, and one of the big issues for us as legislators would be if our constituents were having their DNA captured and utilized without their knowledge or consent, I think that's one of the larger kind of philosophical questions that we're, as legislators, need to walk through. But I think if you want to talk a little bit about the databases and websites, or the databases that you do use, and the opt-in procedures that people go through.
Sure. There are three databases that are consented for law enforcement use right now. Our own, DNA Solves, it's purpose-built only for this. GenMatch and FamilyTree DNA, and we use all three. And then they have FamilyTree DNA is opt-out, I believe, and GenMatch is opt-in. For law enforcement use. Obviously, you would never put your DNA in Authorum's database unless you were trying to find someone or you wanted to help law enforcement with an investigation. You know, I'm going to touch back a little bit on the question before. I do think that the I don't think it's a deterrent for crime yet, but I do think this technology can become a deterrent for crime. If you knew that all that was needed was 15 cells, I mean, it's impossible not to leave 15 cells and commit a crime, and you'd eventually get caught for that crime, then I think, you know, maybe in some day that becomes a deterrent. Also, if we could catch a perpetrator the first time they commit a sex assault, the first time they commit a crime, and not have to wait for the second, third, and fourth time they commit a crime, then I think that in itself will become a deterrent to future crimes. So I'm hopeful.
Great. Any other questions? We have one in the back. A microphone back there, and one up front here.
When your technology is analyzing hair samples, does it need the bulb or the root, or can it do it just off the strain?
Sorry, I couldn't hear.
When you're utilizing hair samples, do you need the bulb, the root, or just part of the strain?
You want to answer that?
Yeah, our technology is not based on requiring a root. Root's always better, but we'll do it from rootless hair as well.
And just two more. Are you selling your technology or licensing it to local police departments or their labs?
Our technology is available to any local, state, or federal agency in the U.S., and we actually have a service kind of model that allows basically even the smallest, we work with some of the smallest, most rural agencies don't even have their own self-sustaining crime lab, and the process works such that if they have evidence, we can help them out regardless. So we've deployed our technology to the largest and the smallest agencies.
Awesome. And then my final question is, has your methodology satisfied either Daubert or Fry, or both, or does it satisfy both?
Yeah, so as Kristen, I think, mentioned in her talk, our technology was questioned in a Daubert hearing during the Carla Walker capital murder trial. And and a group of our peers, rather forensic peers, defended that it was appropriate to use.
Okay, I think we have one last question up here.
All right,
So I know you guys mentioned that like departments still don't communicate with each other the way they should be on certain cases, things like that. And earlier you also talked about the funding. Is that a, more of a funding issue? Is that just more like departments are just have that social issue that they're just not talking to each other? Or would there be able to be like a database where all agencies can communicate? Because I feel like a lot of criminals do commit crimes in different states or different counties because they know it's harder for counties to be talking to each other for their information to be shared. Is there a way for funding or anything where all agencies, whether it's federal, whatever, local, everyone is communicating with each other to help deter that on, well, if I commit a crime in Denver, Denver's not gonna talk to down to Alamosa County, so if I commit a crime there, they're not gonna talk to each other. If I go across state lines, they're not gonna talk to each other there.
Well, there's a couple of good examples. Did you want to answer?
No, I just wanted to add, I guess the question would really would be, are there federal databases for DNA? And,
yes.
And how does that, how do cities and localities upload into that?
There's two things I'd tell you. The first one is, I think actually you demonstrated that the willingness and eagerness for folks to talk is great. It seems like only in the movies that you would see this great collaboration between Denver PD and the Texas Rangers. And we work a lot with the Rangers, they're a lot of fun. So the interest and the enthusiasm, and as he said, the dedication and their willingness to work off the clock is there. So it is a funding problem, and there's some good examples of how funding has helped. So for unidentified remains, where someone goes missing in one state but is found somewhere else, they did an experiment. They started what's called NamUs. It's currently administered by RTI and the National Institute of Justice. They applied money to it, they got immediate value. All of a sudden, they're reporting missing folks, unidentified folks, and putting them together. They just recently renewed the funding. They've added funding to do things like, for example, leverage authoring technology to identify through DNA who they are, instant value. So it is very much a funding problem, and I think databases are a good part of it. That's what NamUs does, that's what CODIS does. But I think there's also just modern technology and software that can improve communication and comparisons of these cases.
Great. I think that's really all the time we have. And I think the one takeaway that I've gotten from this is really that state legislators and the municipalities really should think about putting some more resources towards solving cold cases, that the new technology is emerging, and that whether it's federal dollars, state dollars, or local dollars, us spending some of this could really provide closure for individuals and justice for those who perpetrated the crime. Thank you so much for attending. And we'll be just standing outside here afterwards if you have any further questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you.